Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Sunday evening, October 26, 2008. It is now about 8:01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Of course, you can email us anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. If you are listening to a rebroadcast, you can also phone in your comments to area code 918-919-0101. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, my2centsonline.com. That's my2centsonline.com. And that 2 is a numeric 2. Andy discusses economic issues and how they can affect you. You can also hear his commentary on contraryinvestorscafe.com. That's contraryinvestorscafe.com. Hey, folks, the reason why I tout that Andy Sutton's website, I don't get paid for that, by the way. I do that just because it's a service to my listeners. Andy is an economist, and he sees very clearly what is going on. He takes a macroeconomic point of view. He doesn't look at the particular stock, so to speak, or the stock market itself, but he looks at the economic conditions not only domestically but internationally, and he tries to bring them home in Dick and Jane language, if you will. That's the stuff that I need to understand. And I always understand what he has to say. His newsletter is absolutely free of charge. It's the best in the business, and it's free of charge. He does have a subscription service. It's about $49 a year or $39 a year, where you can actually call him and ask him for advice, and he gives recommendations on stocks and stuff like that. And both subscriptions are excellent. I do invite you. And his commentary on contraryinvestorscafe.com is very, very interesting and enlightening. Boy, do we need that today. There seems to be a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the market. What is happening right now is that it's not unusual to see swings, actual swings of 800 points in the Dow Jones Industrial Average in one day. When I say swings, that means it doesn't end up below 800 or above 800. When it does, it may go down 4 and then come up. Be down 400 on the Dow, and then move up 400 on the Dow, and you have an 800-point swing. Well, you know, folks, that's about 10% in one day. 10% of the Dow shifting in one day. And what does that tell you? Well, it tells you that the market, that when we say the market, there's no such thing as the market. That means those people who are investing, the traders as well as the investors, you know, are uncertain as to what to do. And the traders, at least, are following the last lead. If it looks like things are going to go up, they jump on the bandwagon. Hopefully, they'll buy, and then minutes later, they'll sell for a little bit of profit because this may be their last opportunity. And when you see this volatility, that means people truly do not understand what is going on. And people are not patient enough to take a long-term perspective on things. For example, when the government announced this bailout, the Dow went up 700, 800 points that day or something like that. You know, and the next day, it went down. I mean, it just crashed all over again. That's because realization sets in. And when I say realization sets in, that's when people sit down and say, fine, what exactly is this going to do? Well, now we're finding out that the 700,000 or 900,000, I think it's 900 billion dollar, quote, bailout, assistance, financial availability, whatever you want to call it, is now not going exactly to where they said they was intended to go. Now, all of a sudden, it's going to places that were never intended. They were never spoken of before. They're going to banks to buy other banks to facilitate mergers and all this stuff. I mean, crazy stuff. And everyone's going nuts saying, hey, wait a minute. You never said you were going to do this. We thought you were going to just bail out a bank or, you know, if that was going to go under or that so people didn't lose their money and bail out some mortgages so people didn't lose their homes. And now they're doing everything but that. See, the problem is, folks, is that the government doesn't know what to do. They are doing things they do not know what to do. There is a statement here. This is by David R. Henderson, and he writes Central Planning at Home and Abroad. And he says, my main pragmatic argument against the bailout is that government, by choosing where $700 billion go, is essentially engaging in central planning. Government officials think they can do a better job than decentralized free markets can do at allocating resources. And I couldn't agree more. You know, and you have to be extremely careful of what you read and what people say. Oh, by the way, folks, let me just start. This is going to be just an abbreviated program, just a half hour this evening. Not that I want to tell you my medical condition, but I sprained my back somehow, and it's been killing me for days. I've been doing this, and I'm just not in a very, very good mood when your back hurts. And anyway, so I'll try to muddle through this thing as best I could. So be patient with me. But let me continue. But you must really be careful in what you read. For example, just this morning, I read an article that talked about comparing today's environment with prior financial dilemmas or crises or whatever you want to call them. And they say, and they use the number of banks that have gone under as their focal point. And what they're saying is that, well, geez, you know, back in the early 81, 82 area time frame, about 2,500 banks went under. Today, only 1,500 banks went under. So they're saying, if we think things are bad now, things were much worse back then. Now, that sounds very promising. It says, well, geez, you know, things can't possibly be bad, right? Because, you know, these 2,500 banks and, you know, but just think, 2,500 banks went under, and yet we survived. We have 15 banks going under, and we can't. Well, first of all, the financial condition of the economy, the general economy back then was very different than what it is now. But here's the point. The point is that the government didn't bail out 2,500 banks. Today, the government is bailing out the 2,500 banks. So you've got to be careful what you read. It almost seems as if everything is okay when things are not only not okay, but the action being taken to ameliorate the situation is disastrous long term. And we must take a long-term approach on this. We should allow the banks to fail. If the amount of money deposited with the banks is covered by the FDIC, the FDIC somehow has got to come up with the money. Now, if that means that the government's got to print more money, that's unfortunate. We all lose in that case. But that they cannot renege on that. They should have sufficient funds. Now, they never have sufficient funds. They only have sufficient funds if just a couple of banks go under. But when there is wholesale concern and people start withdrawing money from the banks wholesale, I mean, nationwide, the FDIC can't handle with 1% of that stuff. So we have a problem, but they still should make it good. Unfortunately, it's going to come and bite us through through inflation later on. We're going to pay for it. But today, we have a situation that's not the same as 1930 to 1929 or 1930. Actually, 1929 is when the stock market crash was, and that did not cause the Depression. It had nothing to do with the Depression, actually. But or had very little to do with the Depression, actually. It was just the result of bad loose money at the time, by the way, but I won't get into that. But and then now we have situations that we compare with the 1980s, the 1970s, you know, during the high inflation rates, and it's not the same. You see, back then, we weren't the country that was so heavily in debt. There were no hedge funds. And we're talking hedge funds that have notional values. That means the value of the securities, the actual value, the value of the securities that they're hedging, if you take the total of that, is in the quadrillions of dollars. Quadrillion, folks, that's $1,000 trillion. And they are going bankrupt. They are going bust. Next week, if in fact these hedge funds start folding up, and by the way, 350 already have folded up, but good thing they were relatively small ones, but if some real big ones fold up, this economy, financial situation in our economy will totally collapse. Now, another thing that we got to take in consideration is that now oil is being traded on certain exchanges, not in petrodollars. They're using something else. They're using a basket of currencies, or they're using a euro. Now, the problem with that is people hold dollars so they can buy oil, right? Because oil is traded in dollars. Once they don't need dollars, let's say they need euros, or they need the dinar, or they need the ruble, or whatever the currency is going to be used, they start dumping dollars. Once they dump dollars, we are going to experience hyperinflation that you have never seen before. We are talking about all disastrous outcomes, and it could be any one of hundreds of things that could happen. We just don't know if they will happen, if ever, and we don't know when it's going to come. But we know it's not good. We know it's not good. No one knows that it is good. I mean, everyone knows it's not good. Let me put it that way. Everyone knows it's not good, and everyone's trying to put, you know, as they say, lipstick on a pig here. And you can't do that. My wife just asked me the other day, she said, well, what would you recommend? I said, let them fail. Let them fail. I want to see things fail. I have failed in business. I remember in my business once, not to give secrets away, and I sat there and I had a person steal all my accounts from me, my database. It was horrible. And I sat there in the office and I looked at our schedule book. Now, we need countless thousands of dollars just to break even on fixed expenses every month. And I stood there and I looked at, this was the end of March, and I looked at the April schedule, and we had total revenues booked of $650. Folks, I cannot tell you, I cannot stress how devastating that is, and how devastating that was, and how much money I lost, and how hard I had to work day and night for 3 years just to come back to break even again. I mean, companies must fail. And if they are going to fail, they're going to have to work their way out. I received no government assistance. I took loans from no one. I took loans from myself. I literally stopped spending every dime. I watched every paperclip, and I did as much as I could myself. And as things got better, I started hiring people to do the work again. And it worked. And now my company is stronger than ever. I don't work there anymore. I'm retired. I hope you just keep it going. You know, don't bother too much. I'll help out. But it is going. And it is now the largest industrial health and testing company in the state of Oklahoma. You know, you have to fail. You have to go through that. You have to go through the agony. But this is like a football team saying, no one's going to help the football team except in the fourth quarter at the 2-minute warning. If you're behind, we're going to give you extra points. What kind of football game would that be? All right, now, enough of that. People ask me who I'm voting for and why. Well, I would only vote for either McCain or Obama if literally my family's life was in danger. And that's how strongly I feel about it. I mean, my family's life would have to be in danger. They say, if you don't, your family's life and health is going to be compromised. Then I would say, okay, now I'll vote. That's how strong I feel. And if I was in that position and I absolutely had to, now if they say, well, shoot you, I'd say, shoot, I'm not voting. That's how strongly I feel about it. And the reason why I chose one side over the other is because I want a divided government. I want a government that has checks and balances. And if we have a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, the checks and balances are watered down. Now, we really don't have checks and balances. Look what happened when Pelosi took over Congress. Nothing. I mean, what kind of checks and balances did we have on King Bush? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I mean, she played along. I mean, she spoke a good game. Nothing changed. Nothing at all. There should have been, when she got into office and the Democrats took control of the House and the Senate, there should have been a revolution. We had Kucinich trying to impeach the president, and he couldn't get any Democrats to go along with him. I mean, there should have been a revolution, and there was nothing. There was no outrage, no nothing. So when I say I prefer a divided House, I say that tongue-in-cheek because I know that even if there is a divided House, they're not really divided. It's the same party. There's just two different fractions, and they play a game on us, and we pick up the tab. But I would vote for McCain because he's a Republican, and having a Democratic House and a Republican in the executive branch, that gives a little bit more division of separation of government. Anyway, for whatever that's worth. Now, last week we talked a little bit about private roads, and I had mentioned that I'm an admirer of Jesse Ventura, and he wrote a book, Don't Start the Revolution Without Me, which I highly recommend. I haven't read it, but I'm sure it's an interesting book. And he's a small L libertarian. And at that time, I had mentioned that he had mentioned in his book tour that he thought that the hardcore libertarians or Libertarian Party were anarchist. They actually believed in private roads. And he says that's where he draws the line. He thinks roads should be their public domain and they should be handled by the state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And blah, 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 blah. And I stood there and I screamed at him. Of course, he couldn't hear me because I was watching him on television. That didn't help, screaming at the TV at all, because he really missed a point. And then last week, I gave the example. Oh, he gave the example. What if I had a road, I'd put a toll gate up there, and he says, I'd soak everybody. I'd make a fortune. You know, I would just collect the money, and that's it, and wouldn't let anyone go through unless they pay the toll. And I stood there. I said, you know, Jesse, you're a real sharp guy. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Absolutely the dumbest thing I ever heard. And then last week we talked about him building a road and how much it would cost, and depending on the size of the road. You know, it costs $10,000 a foot to build a road these days, not a yard or something like that. So if he had a road that was going to be a quarter mile long or a mile long, I mean, the cost would be phenomenal. Number one, the cost of the toll booth, and then you got to pay somebody to collect the tolls or have an automatic toll system. You have to build something that people don't drive around the toll. I mean, it goes on. Then you have to maintain the roads, and then you have to guarantee that you'll have at least, you know, enough traffic on that road to justify paving it. Ba-bing, ba-da-bang, ba-da-boom, ba-da-bing, you know. And when you think of it, you say, why would he build a road? To put up a toll booth? Maybe he would collect a quarter and it would cost him maybe $1 million. You know, not a real good investment. And you see, you know, people don't think. Well, first of all, I don't want the state nor the federal government owning anything. That's socialism. The state and the government should own absolutely nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Not the water treatment plants, not the sewage plant, nothing. There's no reason for them to do that. They're inefficient. They don't operate very well. They're very costly. And they usually run in the red. I don't want the states to own anything. There's no reason to. But when we get to roads, we go, well, we gotta have the roads built by the state. We can't have private people building roads. Well, why not? Because, well, now, obviously, the way we look at it, we see our world today, and we go, well, what would happen if, you know, all of a sudden the road in front of my house was privatized and the guy closed it up? Well, we're not talking about the road in front of your house, all of a sudden someone buying it and saying, sorry, you can't ride on it anymore. I mean, that's stupid. We're not talking about that. Now, how we convert these roads to private roads is another matter. But we can start, for example, with where there are no roads. If there are no roads leading nowhere, right, no problem, right? But then if someone wants to build a road, there is a reason for them building a road. Let's assume for a second a developer develops a large area and puts homes and office buildings in a particular area. Now, if he wants to develop that area, people have to find a way to get there. They're not going to trudge through grassland. They're not going to take horses. They're not going to take four-wheelers over there. They're going to want to drive on roads. So they have to decide whether or not a road is worth building, because the payback will be the rents or the sale or whatever it is, the improvement of the road going there. Now, that's all part of the equation. Then they got to figure out whether or not... Now, let's assume for a second they say, okay, we're going to build this road, and we're going to make it go to this shopping center, right? And they build a road. And then they let the road go to hell in the handbasket. There are big potholes. There are just... I mean, it's horrible. They built it. It falls apart. It was built cheaply. You know, you say, ha-ha! You see, now if the city was taking care of the state, that would road would be repaired all the time, blah, blah, blah. It wouldn't be in the condition it's in. But no, because if the road's in bad shape, what's going to happen is that the people on that road, the people who rely on that road for income, they're going to lose their customers. There's going to be shops there saying, well, geez, how come no one's coming to my store to buy stuff? And people will say, because I'm not going to take that cruddy road over there. I go someplace else because there's a beautifully paved road, and I don't ruin my tires and my front end and, you know, get my car out of balance, my wheels out of balance and stuff like that. I hate riding that road, so I'm never going to that shopping center. You see, folks, we cannot just take a situation and say, well, since someone owns the road, they're going to put up a big toll, not allow anyone to go through, and they're going to restrict commerce. It's stupid. What will happen is the free market will determine what kind of road goes there, how much maintenance is done on that road, you know, and it will not cost everybody. Now, don't you think it's quite unfair for a person who lives in a community that takes public transportation to pay for all the roads that cars are on? Think about that. If you're talking about being fair to the citizens, being fair to those people who don't make a lot of money. If you don't make a lot of money and you cannot even afford a car, that means you're not riding on the roads. But you're paying for them. But we never say that, do we? We always say, well, we're going to give tax credits to those people. Well, why tax them and give them the money back to them? Why do we need this gigantic bureaucracy to funnel money back and forth, back and forth? And of course, the state always takes a cut. And that's how the politicians get into office in the first place. There's a real fundamental problem with our thinking. If there is public transportation, when I say public transportation, I mean mass transportation, not public, but mass transportation. Mass transportation should not be run by the city, should not be run by the state, nor the federal government. It should be private. If I elect to take the bus, I will take the bus. I will pay for it. If I don't take the bus, I don't want to pay for it. Now, believe it or not, I actually walk to a bus stop. It's a mile and a half from my house, and I walk to a bus stop, and on occasion, I take a bus. It's great exercise. I get to read on the bus, and that's how I go to the office once in a while when I visit or when I want to go downtown. I truly enjoy doing that. It sure beats getting in a car, sitting in traffic, and worrying about everything else. And by the way, worrying about the potholes that the city fixes. Now, do we have examples of that now? Sure we do. Most of the states right now are trying to divest themselves. Trying to divest themselves of the roads. And what are they doing? They're allowing turnpikes to be built. Ooh, people get scared. Ooh, turnpikes, ooh, cost so much money. Ooh. Yes, turnpikes cost a lot of money. But typically, turnpikes are in excellent shape. You ever notice that? I mean, the roads are really very, very good. I mean, you don't see turnpikes with big potholes and crap like that on it. Because the people who drive on it pay for it. And if it requires more money to maintain it, the price goes up. Now, if people don't want to do that, there's always alternative roads that they can take. I'm just saying that, you know, we have that situation right now. And I like turnpikes, you know, with this toll booths. I like that. Because if I don't drive on that turnpike, I don't pay anything. If I decide to stay home and walk to a library and read a book, I don't want to pay for the road. That isn't, that's truly a free enterprise system, and that's the way it should work. Does anyone deny that? Will anyone argue, rather, that the turnpikes are in worse shape than, generally speaking, than other roads? You'd have a real tough time convincing me of that. See, the fact is, the turnpikes are your best paved roads. And why are the states trying to divest themselves of the roads? Because they can't afford them anymore. Now, we say, well, the roads are free. They're not free. They've got to come from tax dollars. And we know that the states are not very efficient. We know they're going to hire all sorts of people and have all sorts of benefits, and, you know, people don't show up for work. And, you know, the only way you can get fired from a state job is if you're on videotape just doing something horrible. You know, I mean, it just doesn't work very well. It's just very, very expensive. So, Jesse, you really need to take a lesson in some basic economics and apply them to the roads. Roads are no different than any other product or any other service. Nothing is the same. They're all the same. Isn't it strange that our telephones are not government-run? They probably will be someday, but they're not government-run now. Isn't it strange that the internet is not government-run? Hopefully it never will be. Because this station would be off the air. You know it and I know it. The free enterprise system really works. And the free enterprise system did not cause our financial collapse, our financial dilemma. In fact, it was the lack of a free enterprise system that caused it. It was government. We'll talk about that some other time. Geez, it's almost time. Now we only have 2 minutes left. This is Joe Cristiano. I'm your host for Liberty Talk Radio. This half hour really flew by. In fact, I didn't even give station identification. Poo-poo on me. Yes, this is Joe Cristiano, Liberty Talk Radio. Our call-in number after hours, I mean on a rebroadcast, is 918-919-0101. Or you can send me comments, and please do send me comments. I want to hear what you have to say about this subject, because it's a lot easier if I get your comments and then I can respond to them. Hopefully this will be an educational talk show. This is not a political talk show. It's an educational talk show. So hopefully we'll learn from one another. Please send any comments you have. I mean, especially if you disagree. Especially if you disagree, to comments at libertytalkradio.com. That's comments at libertytalkradio.com. Okay. Our next live broadcast will be Thursday at 6:30 a.m. That's 6:30 a.m. Central Daylight Time. This is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending to this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments at libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you are either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free, liberated. Your life is in your own hands. But with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. You now have no control over your bike, and it's no fun anymore. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal. The government hates competition." With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.